Hey folks, you're listening to the audio version of the American Watchmen Roundtable podcast. But did you know you can watch us on YouTube live as well? That's right, every Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you too can join in on the fun. Just go to our website, AmericanWatchmen.org, and click on the YouTube icon, and we redirected to our channel. From there, you can subscribe to our channel to receive updates as to when we're doing this podcast live, and then you can participate every Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time by participating in our chat room. We hope to see you there in future episodes, and of course, you'll always be getting the audio podcast episodes as well if you subscribe. We appreciate your support. And with that in mind, let's begin the show. Thank you. And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the American Watchmen Roundtable. I'm your host, Sam Whitfield, joined here by my co-founders here at American Watchmen, who, you know, I guess whichever one of you guys wants to introduce yourself first, feel free and go ahead.
We need to draw straws to start determining this. I'll go ahead since I already started talking. I'm Joshua Johnson. I'm a co-founder and editor at American Watchmen, and that is all I have to say.
I'm Adam. I'm also a co-founder and editor at American Watchmen, a constitutional conservative from Denver, Colorado.
Sam, have you introduced yourself yet?
Yeah, I introduced myself.
Okay. All right. Well, then in that case, I'll introduce myself. I'm Gabe Iacobone. I'm a co-founder of American Watchmen, and I'll be moderating the topic tonight.
Excellent. So with that in mind, Gabe, what will we be discussing tonight? Tell us.
Sure. So we'll be discussing Trump and foreign policy, and specifically Trump's foreign policy in relation to what is known as the Western Alliance and his relations with Asia. So I'll start us off with a little background, and it may be familiar to some of the viewers here, but Trump was very unusual during the 2016 campaign because his rhetoric and the way he spoke about the Western Alliance was very different than how past Republican presidents and even Hillary Clinton spoke about it. And so over the course of the last year or so, Trump has not changed his stance in terms of sort of viewing our alliance, our system of alliances, and how we talk or work with the world, in terms of not necessarily supporting like this massive system of alliances, but more working with a nation or a set of nations on an individual basis. So last Wednesday, when Donald Trump was campaigning for Matt Rosendale, who's the Republican Senate candidate in Montana, Trump reiterated what he's been saying for a while, that he is willing to walk away from NATO if none of the NATO countries reach what's known as the 2% agreement, which is that every nation that belongs to NATO has a requirement they have to spend 2% of their GDP on their own defense. And it fits a pattern of Trump saying to our allies, if you don't carry your own weight, we're not necessarily going to back you up. So I am curious what you guys kind of think about that and how it's kind of reshaping you know, the way the world works with us, and what it says of Trump when he makes those kinds of statements.
If I may go ahead.
Josh.
There's a bit of an echo there from my end. I was wondering what that was. But if I may go ahead and sort of discuss it, the whole bit about you have to pull your own weight or we're not going to help you. Trump's been a lot more blunt and a lot more forceful about that, but he's not the first U.S. president to bring this up. Obama, even though the media never mentioned it because at the time it wasn't, because it was Obama, it wasn't something to panic about yet. President Obama began actually saying that to several NATO members, and particularly Germany, if I recall, that they need to make their 2% contribution of their GDP to defense spending, or else the U.S. is going to have to, whatever. He didn't really say. He wasn't quite as forceful with Trump as Trump was. And it's interesting because I think part of the reason Trump heavily prioritizes this isn't just because of his America First stance, but because of his wider understanding of the geopolitical situation globally, which is vastly different than many of the elites in the U.S. foreign policy establishment like Obama. And it's weird in that respect because Trump is older than Obama, and Obama was the one who told Mitt Romney that the 1980s called they want their foreign policy back, even though he was running with the same sort of foreign policy ideas. And so it's interesting because Trump is I don't know if what his generation is, but I'm going to go ahead and call him a baby boomer. But he aligns more with millennials and future generations in his geopolitical understanding than a younger president like Obama did. And what I mean by that is he understands that the Soviet Union is not around anymore. Russia is not our number one adversary. They don't have the military strength to even try and be our number one adversary. But that our number one adversary is China, and we need to start countering that. And he has continued in that respect, Obama's pivot to Asia, but just like with NATO, he's been a heck of a lot more aggressive about it. And I'm going to shut up now because I feel like I've been monologuing for too long. But
no, I think you make a good point, and I kind of want to just bounce off that. I think, Josh, you're right in the sense that Trump does identify with millennials and younger people on foreign policy. I also think too, the fact that Trump is an entrepreneur and a businessman who has done business overseas, I think the business aspect of his deal, of his dealings, has certainly influenced his view of the world. And I think when you're a businessman, your outlook on global politics might be different than that of someone who is purely a politician. And more specifically, you know, Trump is the first president ever to have gone from the private sector directly to serving as president of the United States. That was one of the big appeals for many people, including myself, for why I voted for him, that we were actually going to have a businessman and an entrepreneur and someone who knows how to deal with foreign relations as a businessman. So I think, you know, I think that's been helpful to him so far. And, you know, I think it'll be interesting to see how it continues to play out in the future. Other than that, I'm not quite as knowledgeable on, you know, foreign trade and that as perhaps Joshua is, but
the Belt and Road, that's the number one concern in Trump's mind right now, but I'm sure we'll get into that later.
But what I was saying is those are just my two cents as someone who is more of a Middle Eastern foreign policy guy, but we'll get to that in a few weeks. So
I think what's interesting, this dovetails with another question, is Trump is more blunt and forceful when he speaks, but what I think really roils or makes certain circles of, you know, you can call it establishment, you can call it the foreign policy elite, uncomfortable is when Trump speaks of allies and nemesis, or at least countries, you know, we don't really like, he tends to conflate the two in that he'll say things like, he'll say of Europe, for example, something like, you know, you don't pull your own weight, but you do good things. But he'll speak of North Korea in the same way, like, oh, they're starving, but oh, I like Kim Jong-il because he's a strong leader. Trump doesn't differentiate between our allies and our enemies in terms of rhetoric, as opposed to former presidents who have always spoken in those broad terms like, you know, we have shared ideals and we have shared values and we all love democracy and all these countries that we don't like, they don't. And I think that's new and unique, at least in terms of the rhetoric, because I don't know yet if Trump has really done anything different in a concrete sense in terms of action in foreign policy, but his rhetoric is certainly different. And this kind of dovetails into my next question, like I said, which is, what does that reveal about Trump's foreign policy? Does he really mean what he says, or is this more of the businessman type, I want to keep everybody off balance so I can have a leg up when I'm in negotiations or when I'm dealing with these countries?
You make a good point, and I'm going to answer that like this. Before you can do, all right, from a businessman's perspective, before I can get you to sign on to, and when I say you, I'm referring to the American public, to the American body politic more large, before I can get you to sign on to something concrete, we have to have a paradigm shift, right? I have to convince you, I have to persuade you. And you mentioned that in his rhetoric, he does not differentiate between, for example, well, people may be starving in North Korea, but I like Kim Jong-un because he is a strong leader. And he doesn't differentiate, and that bothers the older foreign policy elite. That is part of a paradigm shift. He has to lay that groundwork before he can do anything concrete. What do I mean by that? Because, as I understand it, Trump has an acute, and maybe I'm jumping the gun by getting too much into this topic already, but he has an acute understanding that the old Cold War is over and a new one is beginning. Except it's not, as the mainstream media would have you believe, it's not with Russia, it's with Xi Jinping's China. And what in the old Cold War, how did both camps behave? Both the U.S. and the USSR said, if you're in our camp, you have to agree with us. I'm America. If you're in the American bloc, if you will, you're going to have your policies mirror my own. You're going to do what I tell you to do. You're going to be a democracy, blah, 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 blah. The Soviet Union, you're going to be communist. You're going to do it this way. If you don't do it this way, we're going to send the tanks in on you. If you didn't do it America's way, as Chile found out with Salvador Allende, we'll send the CIA in after you and do a forced military coup regime change. And that was how the old Cold War worked. The two superpowers mirrored each other in their approach with their allies. In the new one, Trump understands that we have a little catching up to do with China because they've been aware of the geopolitical situation post 1991 more than the American foreign policy elite have. And how have they chosen to play with the world, particularly those that they wish to do business with? I forget the name of the term, but there's an actual doctrine in Chinese foreign policy which essentially says, we do not give a crap how you run your domestic affairs. We only care if you align with us or oppose us on foreign policy issues. And Trump sort of gears into that when you mentioned the North Korea deal. Or any other country he's spoken about like this. America, in order to begin mirroring China on this and sort of getting the paradigm shift for the second Cold War with them, if you will, Trump understands that America is going to have to say, look, we don't care necessarily what your domestic agenda looks like, so long as you are not actively threatening or opposing us. And the thing that's interesting about the way he's sort of reshaping America's alliance is going into this with a general pivot, not just to Asia, but as Foreign Policy Magazine noted, moving more and more of our trade into Eastern Europe, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, Italy, maybe even Russia after the Helsinki summit. It indicates that Trump understands that, how to phrase this, he understands that in this new Cold War, we can't particularly afford to to constantly call the shots, because China hasn't done that with their own circle. They've allowed them a level of autonomy, if you will. They've been multipolar. There's a general block that works and prefers to deal with one another, an alliance, if you will. But it's no longer, as it was in the old Cold War, America or the Soviet Union dictating to you what you were going to do all of the time. It's more, we're going to work together and cooperate where we can because we have to be allies. But we're going to do what you want sometimes, and we'll do what we want sometimes, and that's okay. And that's very upsetting to many in the foreign policy elite who have a sort of imperial mindset of America telling other countries what to do, or constantly viewing, with particular respect to Russia, viewing them as a country that cannot be on equal terms with us. And Trump sort of sees, especially encountering China, that if we're going to work with Russia, we're going to have to approach them as equals. We're not going to be able to approach them like America might have approached Great Britain in the past, or the United Kingdom.
Well, let me just say this, Josh, because I think that's an interesting point. You bring up the fact that America is imperial, right? And a lot of people, especially kind of in the MAGA side, they see that, they think of John Bolton, and they think of people like, you know, John Bolton and those types of old foreign policy guys as being, you know, bad or evil. And as I've explained to many people, and as I'll explain now, I don't think the old war hawk mentality is necessarily evil. I think it comes from a place of, in fact, I talked to one of Bolton's assistants about this a few years ago when I was at the Western Conservative Summit. And basically, what Bolton's and what kind of the old neocon war hawk mentality stems from is World War II and 70 years ago. Basically, when we had an obligation morally and economically to step up and lead the world and lead the charge against, you know, Hitler and the Axis powers, we no longer have to burden that type of responsibility on our shoulders. And yet, a lot of these neoconservatives think that that's how we had to deal with the whole entire world. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I don't think it's bad in terms of intentions, but, you know, I do think that you're right, that, you know, things need to change. Trump does understand that. So
everybody's a slave or a prisoner of their own generation. You know, if you grew up in that era, then of course it's going to be your view. If you grew up during the Cold War and Russia was always the enemy, then of course you're going to be naturally more suspicious of them. Or millennials, even for the life, no matter what the negative consequences might be, you're going to have a hell of a time trying to convince millennials that there's reasonable restraints or bad things about technology. Everybody grows up with their own generational mindset, and that's hard to break. Winston Churchill is a great example of this. Following World War II, the United Kingdom simply did not have the clout anymore to be the world's premier Western superpower as they had been. And the leadership needed to focus on domestic issues, and Churchill simply couldn't do that. He was so steeped in the past that he continued to look solely at foreign policy, ignoring the home front entirely in the years immediately after the war. And this is what led to his stunning, and he was truly a horrible domestic prime minister. He did great as a wartime one. He sucked as a domestic peacetime one, precisely because he looked at foreign policy all the time. And that's why the Tories lost. And then when they did win, Anthony Eden wound up taking him out. Because they needed to have an administration that was focused. He was making the same mistakes again. They needed to focus on domestic issues, and Churchill, because of the generation he grew up in, mentally couldn't bring himself to do that. And I think John Bolton's sort of in the same camp.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, Winston Churchill, I think, is arguably one of the greatest, certainly he's one of my, favorite historical figures. I think he was instrumental in bringing down the Nazis. But again, He, as you said, he was in that war, kind of wartime mindset, and didn't really have the domestic, wherewithal. I think same, So I think going back to Trump, I think that's kind of the whole thing with, you know, Bush and Reagan, even to some extent. I think they were both, you know, kind of wartime presidents, so to speak, even though Reagan's was more of a Cold War. And whereas Trump is really the first president I can think of who is more or less a peacetime president. And he has the opportunity, as I said, as a businessman to really focus on the economic side of foreign policy. So,
well, if we follow the generational line of argument, wouldn't Trump be more inclined to behave as past presidents have? I mean, he's a boomer. He's an older boomer, but he's a boomer. He grew up living under the post-World War II consensus, which was the Western Alliance, where you have all these agreements and our shared values and our culture are the things that make the alliance worth it. He's new in that he is, at least in his rhetoric is basically saying, you know, shared values and shared culture is great and all, but it doesn't outweigh the downsides of all of our interlocking alliances that don't allow us to behave in our own self-interest. So wouldn't it make sense, though, that if that was the boomer consensus, why is Trump now trying to change that? Because millennials aren't jumping up and down rooting for Trump. Millennials are the ones that you would think would be the ones going, yeah, we agree with that. We grew up under the Iraq War and the War on Terror, and we haven't won it, and it's been a disaster. Wouldn't they be the ones more likely to jump on board, I guess, that aspect of the Trump train versus Trump's base, which actually is older, whiter, more blue-collar? They're actually the ones who also grew up under this post-World War II consensus, and they're the ones, you know, agreeing with Trump, saying it's not worth it, or at least it's not worth it just to be part of NATO or back up this post-World War consensus because of shared values.
Well,
there are three things. There are three things I could say to that. First, does Trump act like his own age in the first place? It's just kind of a joke, but I mean, it is a valid point. And two, millennials don't really pay too much attention to foreign policy, so I wouldn't expect them to jump up and down for that so much anyway. It seems like they have almost focused, and this sort of goes back to the post-imperial era that we may be living in. They seem much more focused on domestic policy than foreign policy in a way that, you know, say, for example, back to Churchill and Eden. Eden was younger. Eden was already seeing that things were coming apart, and so he was focused inward while Churchill was focused outward. And the third and last thing regarding the older people being the one, you know, the older, whiter generations being the ones that have most emphatically supported Trump is because I think you have to, Trump has done an excellent job of sort of trying to bridge his foreign policy into his domestic policy. And by that, I mean, he doesn't just say that NATO's not working because the allies aren't paying their fair share or they're screwing us in trade deals, or, well, exactly the screwing us in trade deals part, because he tied it into their economic well-being at home and said, well, how's the post-war consensus worked out for you? Are you still having a good, are you still living well? Are you still prospering? And for a lot of those people, the answer is an emphatic no. And so they reject the whole thing. And I think also, and again, I'm going to not say too much about this because I think it might come up later, but we've also seen a massive, massive cultural shift in the last 10 to 15 years or so, which has seen the, you know, what does it mean to be the West? You know, for millennials, that answer might be radically different than what an older person might say. And the ironic thing is that for an older person like John Bolton, to be the West might be family values, Christianity, securing our borders, but increasingly under the post-war consensus, those have become the values that we see in the East. What we see in Russia, for example, where they've been leading a fight to close up their borders, where they've been cracking down on abortion and the LG and the transgender movement and things like that. And it's sort of a bizarre trading of places that has happened within the last 15 or 20 years since the Cold War has ended. That's all I'll say on that.
I will just jump in here and say, Adam, I don't think we've heard much from you, and I know that you're the badass military guy in here. So, do you have any input on this?
Not really. I definitely, I'm just kind of listening to what you guys have to say. I definitely agree. I don't have any disagreements with you guys, really.
Feel free to jump in here if you do have anything to say. I will note too, this kind of just came to me too, but you know, Trump's interesting because he is post World War II, but he also is of the generation where many of his peers were sent over to fight in Vietnam, which is still to this day a very controversial thing. And one of the big arguments I've heard from all of boomers, America First boomers, who were interesting enough, a lot of them, even the veterans I know of, have been very disenfranchised with Vietnam and the reasons we went over there. So one of their whole reasons why they like, you know, President Trump's kind of foreign policy approach is, you know, no more pointless wars like Vietnam was in their mind. So I don't know if that made sense grammatically, but do you think that has anything to do with it, gentlemen? Vietnam at all?
Well, you look at Vietnam War, and we've done some good things with the War on Terror, but the War on Terror, in my opinion, has basically become the modern day Vietnam. It's a war against an ideology. Wars against ideologies are very hard to have any concrete victories, in my opinion.
And part of the problem, I would also add to what Adam said, is because it has become there still is a huge level of hypocrisy in American foreign policy. But if you look at the government we propped up in South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem was anything but a Democrat. The man was a nepotistic dictator who rigged elections and had his brother and his brother's wife helping him. But in Iraq, for example, as Adam pointed out, or even in Vietnam, because there was no objective to take land, we were just trying to kill as many of the enemy, and then they'd retake the hill and we'd go back and forth and we'd be wasting our time. In Iraq, that problem has sort of become self-evident in that we took out a stable government, a government that had kept the region stable and had kept a country that should not have existed at all. Iraq was an artificial creation following the British Empire's withdrawal from the region. Saddam Hussein did an excellent job of holding it together, and we went in, removed that autocratic system that had proven effective, and tried to stick in a liberal democracy, expecting that a pluralistic society was going to take root and bloom. We've sort of become like the Soviet Union, especially the neocons in that regard, in that we seem to think we need to be constantly exporting our ideas all over the place, as opposed to just forming a realpolitik alliance with somebody who we might have a few shared interests with. And it didn't work for the Soviet Union, and it's clearly not working for us. It's getting us into our own Afghanistans, if you will, as Brezhnev found out.
Well, yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Sam. I'll go after you.
Well, all I was going to say is, I think in one of the next panels that we do, in terms of foreign policy, I think the Middle East, and more specifically radical Islam, I think that has a lot to do with it. And I don't want to get too sidetracked, because I could honestly do like a 3-hour panel on that alone and drop like a chalkboard and go all John Madden with what I think the problems are in that part of the world. But, you know, suffice it to say, Josh, I think long story short, you're right. And you know, to kind of simplify things, I think millennials on both sides are just kind of jaded with the Iraq-Afghanistan war. I also think a lot of those, you know, older boomers, I think now a lot of them are realizing that it's their kids too who have gone over to Iraq or, you know, Afghanistan, or who may be going over. to the Middle East. And so I think, you know, a lot of them want to keep their kids home. Whereas, you know, I think the greatest generation with their Vietnam kids, I know this was the case for my late grandfather. He was like, oh, well, I served in World War II, so, and that's what I did. So, son, you know, it's your duty to go over to Vietnam. I don't think parents now have that same mindset. It's, you know, their duty. Well, I mean, I think some parents do, but not in general, if that makes sense. So,
well, I mean, an interesting thing to note about that is as of this year, there will be kids joining the military to fight in the same war that their dad fought in.
Yeah, I know. That's
throughout. Throughout history, there has been, you know, this was essentially the problem that brought down the government of I can't remember his Roman numeral, but the king of France prior to the French Revolution. I think it was Louis the 16th, but don't quote me on that. The 16th part, it might have been a different number. But essentially, the country was badly indebted anyway, and he decided to go and get involved in the American Revolutionary War. Revolution swept the country. The new French communes that took power, the Jacobins, wound up making the exact same mistake because they decided, oh, well, we're going to go and spread the revolution. And a certain faction of the Jacobins had opposed this, but they decided to go to war with Italy anyway. And it did not end well for them. It wound up being the dissolution of their regime, and it was what Napoleon Bonaparte used to come to power. And those who have been wise throughout history have sort of learned from this lesson. Following Lenin's death in the Soviet Union, the huge debate between Stalin and Trotsky was, are we going to have permanent revolution, as Trotsky called it, where we're going to spread the revolution all over the world? Or, as Stalin said, socialism in one country, which essentially said we're just going to mind our own business and secure the regime at home and to hell with the outside world. Stalin won out, and the regime wound up securing its existence for at least another 70 years. The U.S. has not learned this lesson, or at least the neoconservatives haven't, because they've tried spreading their ideology, their liberal democracy, all over the world, and all it's done is drain our coffers, cause instability at home, and destroy our image abroad, and get us bogged down in these pointless conflicts like Afghanistan, Iraq.
Well, I will say, as a sort of counter response to that, although it's not my main point, democracies don't go to war with each other. If there's one positive of going into a country or trying to turn a country into a democracy, democracies don't go to war with each other. I mean, we haven't gone to war with France. England doesn't go to war with us. What I will say, though, about what I think is crystallizing in terms of the impact that Iraq has had on us, you know, and you can compare it to Vietnam of that era, is that Iraq crystallized, I think, for a lot of people that you can't necessarily... You can call it nation building, whatever. Basically, the cost has become insurmountable in terms of what you get out of trying to convince a group of people or a nation state to be a democracy. The one thing that I think Trump has taken away from that, and a lot of older Americans have taken away from Iraq, is that basically the cost of alliances and the cost of being imperialistic, whatever you want to call it, finally outweigh the benefits of, you know, whether it's a democracy or having an allied nation that isn't a democracy. The costs are just too great now.
Yeah,
I would see it in the money that we spent in Iraq, the number of deaths, and just, again, getting bogged down there.
Right. I guess my response, and this, I'm not going to go too far into it because it sort of goes off into discussion of ideologies. But, you know, to the point that democracies don't go to war with each other, which may or may not be true, I'm sitting here trying to think of an example. And the examples I could pull would probably be very old. But the thing is, it's not really so much that as it is countries that share the same ideology don't go to war with each other. I mean, can you think of any two communist countries? I know there was a border skirmish between the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China in the 1960s, but that's still going on now, even though they no longer share any ideological resemblances to one another, and that's because that's a geographical, geopolitical issue that predated both the USSR and the PRC. But otherwise, you don't normally see countries that share an ideology going to war with each other. So that's, I mean, the problem that came out of it essentially was that the USSR and the USA determined that the best way to world peace was we have to convert everybody to our system, regardless of what those people actually want. And I think... Am I still on the line?
Yeah, you're still on.
All right, I just concluded my sentence. I was wondering. there was a pause there, and
All I was going to say, Josh, is I think unless you guys want to discuss it now, I think you were kind of jumping the gun with the whole ideological war, just because that was something I was going to save for the Middle East panel when we have that in a few weeks, because I think, like I said, I think the ideological war kind of ties in with that. But I do think, too, you know, another thing with Iraq and Afghanistan that a lot of people forget is, and maybe I just feel super sensitive to this because I'm personally connected with this, but one of the big things that Iraq and Afghanistan exposed too, it exposed huge cracks in our government, not just in terms of foreign policy, but also with the veterans, with the VA system. You know, one of the big problems, and I think one of the big reasons why so many Americans fell out of favor with the Iraq War was specifically because of the VA system, right? You have veterans going over, losing limbs, and then basically coming back, and the VA, because it's just so mired down in bureaucracy, they're not providing the services that they're supposed to for veterans. Now, you may ask, well, Sam, what is the VA? That's a domestic issue. What does that have to do with foreign policy? I would say a whole hell of a lot, actually. I would say it's a foreign policy issue in my mind, because if we're not willing to take care of our veterans and our soldiers over here when they come back, then, you know, potential soldiers are not going to want to sign up to fight, you know, in a branch of the military that is not going to take care of them, most likely.
I think Sam is hitting the nail on the head in terms of it's another cost, essentially, right? Whether it's in dollars or whether it's in deaths, and whether it's domestic in terms of impacting our domestic policy or internationally, it's another cost. So my question to you guys, building off that and kind of leading us.
Can I jump in and add one thing?
Oh, sure, Josh, go ahead.
Yeah.
Immigration would be another cost as well. I mean, we already touched on that in the immigration discussion a few weeks ago. But, you know, can you just imagine, for example, in the press lately, they had been going around, and I don't think this was Trump's idea, because I've seen from others that it was people like McMaster that were pushing it, but they had supposedly been considering going to war in Venezuela. Can you imagine the flow of refugees up to the southern border if that had happened? So immigration cost as well. A lot of these issues are interconnected like that.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing, too. I mean, a lot of people like to... A lot of people like to separate foreign policy and domestic policy, and the reality is, especially in 21st century, not just America, but the whole entire world, everything is so interconnected now that you literally cannot separate anything. So
my next question is: Do you guys think that this is a that what it's sort of we've seen under Trump and what we've seen from the consequences of Iraq and Afghanistan, do you think it's permanent, or do you think it's something that will fade away and we'll go back to, you know, basically the way it's been before, which was, you know, if you look at it from Vietnam on, where you had Vietnam and you had a very skeptical public about foreign entanglement, and 10 years later, we were right back to doing the same thing we were doing in Vietnam. So my question is, is this basically just a blip in American foreign policy being very assertive and very pro-NATO and spreading our values across the world? Or is this something new, especially keeping in mind this is really the first time we've seen this in the post-Cold War dynamic? Is this something that we're going to see that's going to stay, or is it, like I said, a blip that's going to go back to, you know, where we were before Iraq and Afghanistan and more towards a George Bush, Ronald Reagan kind of foreign policy?
I'll let Sam go first this time.
I was just going to invite Adam to speak up because, Adam, I don't know if you can because you're an active, if you can comment, but I would just speak. Curious because you're the one who, you know, could potentially be on the front lines of all of this since you're the only one of us who is, you know, actively serving. And by the way, thank you for that as well. But, you know, you're kind of out there in the trenches, maybe metaphorically right now. But what do you, you know, see on the horizon?
I mean, I kind of like a lot of the decisions Trump has been making as far as militarily, I mean, with the exception of our involvement in Syria, which, I mean, that's a whole another subject to talk about. I disagreed with that. But I think that Trump really does care about the actual service members a lot more than a previous president. I know Bush did to a point, but I think Trump wants to do anything that he can to try to keep veterans out of harm's way, which I hope that's the case because, again, I don't want to be put out there in the front lines and in any kind of future potential conflict. But I'm really hoping that Trump – and I think that what Trump changes he'll do will actually stick. So,
Gentlemen, Josh?
I think it will stick, but here's the problem. Before you had, it would come down to essentially, well, it depends. If the Democrats win the White House, do we go right back to it? I don't think they're going to win in 2020. And I think that by the time we get to 2024, you're going to see that both parties have radically changed on this issue. And this sort of goes to the, I keep forgetting how to pronounce her name, but I think it's Ocasio Cortez or something like that. I forget her middle name, but her last name is Cortez. The Democratic Socialist in New York, what you've seen is that the populist or the anti-establishment wings, which have been ascendant in both parties in the form of Trump and the Republicans and in the form of her and Sanders on the Democrats, both of them agree on a phenomenal number of foreign policy issues. I know you guys have seen me praising Tulsi Gabbard, the Democrat from Hawaii on foreign policy over the last couple of years. She actually went and she was the only member of Congress, I think, who went and personally met with President Assad in Syria and saw for herself what the truth on the ground was instead of running with the mainstream media's propaganda that always runs with the foreign policy elite. Or Bernie Sanders a few months ago with, I forget the Republican, the libertarian-leaning Republican from Utah. What is his name? Mike Lee. I don't know if he's from Utah or not, but Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders teamed up in the Senate, and the bill was shot down, unfortunately, but they teamed up on a bill that would have ended our involvement in Yemen, which is a humanitarian crisis that's at least on par with, if not worse than Syria, and sees us tacitly going along with Saudi crimes against humanity. And I think because of this shift we see happening in both parties on this issue, I think it's going to be long-term and lasting. The question, the biggest opposition that comes from this, as I understand it, comes from Wall Street, comes from the deep state, comes from the media. And if we were to turn back on this and a whole myriad of other issues, trade, social spending on you know, infrastructure, on entitlement programs, if they were to go back after people have seen administrations or at least politicians or publicly trying to change this stuff, I think it would be a serious blow to the stability of the political system. I don't want to sound like the crazy conspiratorial guy, but essentially I think you could see if they tried to roll these things back, you could see a almost USSR style breakup of the United States. And I wouldn't be the first one to predict that. There were a few KGB analysts after the Cold War, ex-KGB, who predicted things along those lines. not for those particular reasons, but that's where I think that could go. And I don't think that'll happen. But I think these changes will last, and I explained why.
I'll disagree with Josh a little bit and say I think it does depend if a Democrat wins in 2020. One of the interesting things from the polling perspective is you've seen a 180 in the parties in terms of it used to be Republicans who used to say things like alliances are worth it and our alliances strengthen the nation, and it's the exact opposite now. It's the Democrats who are going, oh, no, we need to support NATO. We need to support our trading partners. And it's Republicans who are going, you know, it's not worth it anymore. So I think to a degree, you know, how strong this tendency is and how much of a foothold it can get in the next couple of years partly does depend if Trump wins. Because I think even Bernie Sanders would be less likely than Trump to come out and say things like, I'm going to negotiate with Russia one-on-one, or I'm going to negotiate with a European partner one-on-one, as opposed to go through NATO or go through the EU, because I think fundamentally it might be a nuanced level, but I do believe that Trump, whether he values our alliances or not, he fundamentally believes we get a better deal and it's worth it more if we negotiate one-on-one with a country, regardless of what shared values we have. Whereas there are a lot of Democrats who don't share that. And we'll go, oh, we'll go through the EU, we'll go through NATO, and we'll say the platitudes and talk about our shared values. Whereas I think with Trump, that, you know, that doesn't outweigh what he sees as a benefit of negotiating individually. So I think to a degree, how far this goes along and how much strength it gains during Trump's tenure partly does depend on 2020.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I'd been thinking about this and I didn't know how to work this into our conversation without it seeming like a segue off onto something else. But I'm glad you said what you said, because I think the fundamental difference in the parties is sort of, I mentioned earlier that there is a new Cold War brewing. It's just not with Russia. But the Democratic Party, even their populist wing, I think would disagree with that. And it's because of the value system that Gabe sort of mentioned. Republicans, or especially the Trump base, are more inclined to see China as the rising enemy. And Democrats, especially after Trump lost, not just because they used it as an excuse to wash away Hillary Clinton's own incompetence, but and the fact that everybody hates her, incompetence aside. But the thing is, why there are values in play in terms of the fact that Democrats hate Russia so much and Republicans don't. And that goes to what I said earlier about there being sort of a switch about what does it mean to be Western, because you mentioned common values. Trump, I would say, is more likely to say, yeah, I think we have common values with Russia and that I want us to be a pro-life country. I want us to secure our borders and put our own people first. I want us to be assertive and tough in a way that puts us first, not necessarily some vague international alliance. And Trump or some Republicans would be inclined to say, yeah, we have more shared values with Russia in that regard. But if you ask a Democrat, they would immediately point to the laws against the anti-homosexual propaganda law, the same laws that are cracking down on abortion, the crackdown on Pussy Riot and feminism in general over there. And they would say, no, that's why we can't have anything to do with them. A lot of the Russophobia, as I saw it, began to sort of pop up in 2013, right after Russia passed the first of those anti-homosexual propaganda bills. And it's only grown from there. And it's precisely because both parties, even the populist wings, even though they might share a general sense of anti-interventionism so much, both parties still, and this also ties into the realignment, but I'm not going to get into that right now, because I think we will get some of their voters, like the people like Tulsi Gabbard. But both parties, even the populist wings, do have a radically different, even if they have the general anti-interventionism, they have a radically different idea of who our opponent in this new sort of state, this new chapter in history is. For Republicans, it tends to be China. For Democrats, it's Russia, because Russia and Eastern Europe now represent a fundamental challenge to their to their system of beliefs, because they are rolling the clock back, if you will, on issues that they think you can only quote unquote go forward on.
Josh, you've kind of given me a perfect segue to bring something in that I thought was going to totally be a tangent, but now you've kind of given me the opportunity to bring this in. So you mentioned the fact that you think that we may be headed towards a Cold War with China inevitably, right? Well, then you also mentioned the fact that the mainstream media and the left just in general and Hollywood all seem to be in bed with Russophobia. Now, I actually just did a podcast on this for the Whitfield Report not too long ago, but I'm taking a film class right now over the summer at my college, and one of the things that I've studied is why are there so many box office hits that are either remakes or superhero movies, or why are there so many big budget movies? Well, it's because a lot of these big budget Hollywood films are funded by the Chinese. Now, what does that have to do with foreign policy? Well, if Hollywood is pretty much being propped up by the Chinese now, and it is, then what benefit would they have from us going more towards Russia, with them being more traditional? Basically all the big Hollywood studios are being funded by China now, so that may seem like a bit of a tangent, but I think
it's not so much that they're, and I hope that this segues into Gabe's next question, maybe on trade stuff, but it's not so much that they're funded by China directly. It's that China has a large and growing middle class, or at least they have had that because of their unprecedented in history economic boom over the last few years, but there's signs of that slowing down, and that's why we see a lot of Xi's more repressive actions right now. But the thing about it is, and this shows again how it sort of ties all the issues together, domestic, economic, foreign policy, whatever. But for people in the elite who tend to be neoliberal and who tend to focus a lot of their economics around the worship of the almighty dollar, then you can turn a blind eye to things like China's abuses or China's threatening of America's interests or Russia's interests or whoever, so long as you can keep making money off them. We've seen the European Union, the supposed, you hear the left always holding up Angela Merkel, and the European Union is this beacon of human rights and this beacon of liberty in the world. But the thing is, the European Union Human Rights Council doesn't say anything about China anymore. You know why? Because they want to make money off them. And that's the same deal you see with Hollywood.
Right.
I hope it ties into trade with Gabe's next questions, but we'll see.
Right, exactly. So was that too off base, or do you think my
no, you guys are good. I will say the one thing looping us back to, and it may be a prior point, in terms of whether it's permanent or not, is, and this may be anecdotal more than statistics or data driven, is under Trump you've seen a lot more of the pushback against neoconservative magazines or sites like National Review or the Weekly Standard, where there's now actually there is a conversation within conservative circles about whether it's worthwhile to keep up this system, to prop up the old system. Whereas now what Trump has been saying, and before Trump it was, you could call it a fringe or it was a small group, there's actually a vocal group now that's, and magazines that are starting to talk about it and actually put it into the mainstream. Because one of the things why the post-World War II consensus has been so successful in terms of driving things for the last 50 or 60 years beyond just the neoliberal trade order is that there are a lot of institutions and think tanks that put out all these ideas and op-eds and articles pushing it over and over, year over year, saying the same thing over and over about how going into Iraq was worth it or Afghanistan was worth it. Now you finally have some pushback against that that's actually getting, readers and viewership to actually view it and go, oh, hey, maybe they make a good point. So So they're actually under Trump. We've seen some of that institutional knowledge, you know, and think tanks actually start to come up with ideas and thoughts that, you know, are counter to that kind of neoliberal slash post-World War II consensus. So, I mean, from that perspective, I will say I think there is a chance that it's not just a blip, that we will go forward. So that's just my thoughts on the prior point.
Okay, I think that's we've all talked about so much, you know.
This is my favorite of all the ones we've done so far, just so you know. But that's just because I'm the foreign policy wonk. So
no, I agree. I think this one has gone splendidly. There's just a lot to digest here.
Well, and I think, you know, we can go into trade for a little bit. It wasn't the main point of my moderating, but I will say I think the point about the neoliberal order and trade policies, I think you can, and you guys can elaborate on this. I think you see it in terms of the opposition that has popped up in terms of the tariffs that Trump has put on goods, not just from China, but from Europe. In terms of oh, go ahead, Sam.
Oh, I thought you were done, but you were chipmunking, I guess, or whatever.
Oh no, you're good. Go. I was just gonna elaborate on the point, but you're good, Sam. Go ahead.
Oh, all I was gonna say is, I guess the one thing that drives me crazy, and I specifically want to address, I'm gonna call out my boy, my BOI, Ben Shapiro here, for basically saying that, Adam, just jump back in. Basically, I do want to call Ben Shapiro out for saying that Trump's tariff impositions are not conservative at all. Just because every country has a tariff on us, so I don't really get this. I don't really get Ben's whole logic that us putting tariffs on other countries hurts us negatively.
Well, he's right in the sense that it's not conservative, as conservatism in the United States has been understood since post world order, but that just, you know, ties into the whole realignment we see going on here on all these issues, not just on foreign policy or trade or what have you. And the thing about Ben Shapiro and the problem, Gabe sort of touched on this when he said you have the think tanks that just say the same thing year after year after year after year, and Ben Shapiro repeating as though it was holy writ, you know, as though it was written in the Bible or the Torah or the Quran or whatever, that you have to have free trade. You have to have free trade. It ties into what I call the way our foreign policy elite, which includes Ben Shapiro, he's essentially their propagandist, has sort of become like the old Soviet Union. Except, you know, instead of saying that they repeated the same thing over and over again, the term was that the Marxist used a wooden language. Ceausescu or Brezhnev or whomever would come out and they would repeat these vague Marxist platitudes that were supposed to be holy writ laws of science that couldn't be challenged. But they'd been saying the same thing for over and over again for 50, 60 years. And clearly it wasn't working, but they kept saying it over and over again like they expected it to work. And you see the same thing from a lot of the neoconservatives, especially from people like Ben Shapiro on trade or on foreign policy or on whatever. They repeat the same things over and over and over again because that's what the ideology says. And damn it, the ideology is right. It's almost like a religion to them. They are like the Soviet Marxists in that regard.
Well, plus, folks, his wife is a doctor, okay? So he's married to a doctor, which means he knows stuff. So,
in this case, he's not a doctor's wife; he's a doctor's husband.
Yeah.
So, but I'll piggyback off what Josh said, and there's always been, and not to take us off foreign policy too much, but there's always been sort of an uneasy alliance within conservative circles between, you know, celebrate the flag, celebrate our place, our country, but also love free trade. I think one of the things that Trump has really brought to the fore, and that recent events beyond Trump have brought to the fore, is those two things are almost diametrically opposite to each other now. You can't scream I love free trade and then also scream I love America first, because free trade inherently takes things away from America that if you value America first, you value. And I think those two things have they've kind of been together in a way, and because of the way our politics has been fought, they've been able to coexist. I don't think those two things can coexist anymore.
Let me give you a brief history lesson. Before democracy and republics were the primary form of government in the West, monarchy was up until after World War II. But prior to World War I, there was a distinction. You had liberal monarchies like the United Kingdom, where the monarch didn't wield too much power, where the military didn't wield too much power, and where it was all parliamentary system. And you had what we would liberal monarchies, such as Prussia or the German Empire, where the Kaiser wielded most of the power. He appointed the chancellor. Yes, there was a parliament, but most executive authority was securely in the Kaiser or the chancellor's hands. And the military had a lot of influence, and their cultures were radically different. One was very illiberal and one was very liberal. England at the time, the United Kingdom, was very much free trade. It made sense for them to do that because they had this huge empire that spanned the world, and they had to have all their trade across the ocean. Whereas Prussia, under Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, was infamous, the Junkers were, for being very protectionist. In fact, the German Empire is one of the best examples, and I encourage all of our listeners to study this, one of the best examples of the fact that tariffs do not necessarily mean suffering for the average citizen. There are ways to make it work, and the German Empire is a great example of this, but they were an illiberal monarchy. We see the sort of the same thing happening today, except with democracy. You have the liberal Democrats like Angela Merkel or whomever who go out of their way to have free trade and globalism, if you will. And then you have illiberal Democrats such as Viktor Orban or Salvini or Putin who do not kowtow to this globalist agenda and instead have a more nationalist mindset. That includes a degree of economic protectionism to do what is best for their people and to make sure that they have that sense of place. And we're sort of seeing that dichotomy or that dynamic play out again.
Very, very interesting. And Adam, I think that's you. That's echoing.
Do what?
I think that's you. That's echoing. You don't have headphones or anything in?
I haven't had headphones pretty much this whole time.
Huh. Okay, I was hearing an echo. I don't really have anything to say after Josh's
The essential point, allow me to maybe end it another way. The essential thing is that liberalism, whether people it doesn't like to admit it about itself because that's how it stays in power. But liberalism is an ideology just the same as communism or fascism was. And it does have its own sort of almost quasi-religious tenets that it expects its followers to adhere to, like Ben Shapiro does on free trade, or how the communists did to ensuring that everything was state-owned. What we're seeing is countries turning away from that, but not doing what the ideology claims they would do. Because according to liberalism, your only alternatives where you were either a communist or a fascist, or you were a liberal. But that's been clearly disproven by a lot of the countries we've seen in Eastern Europe, by Russia, by Hungary, by Poland, by now Italy, Austria, Czech Republic, maybe Romania will go.
And it's new. I mean, that's a product of the post-Cold War. Because the Cold War, obviously, there were two sides. There was the U.S. and the West, and there was Russia, and there was the USSR, and their allied nation. So, I mean, I think I don't disagree, Josh. I agree with you fully. I think it's something new that nobody has seen before. And, you know, not to harp on Josh, not to harp on Shapiro too much. I tend not to listen to his stuff because I don't consider it worth it. I think he's like a lot of people in that they cling to their tenets because they get comfort out of it. They don't have to think about a changing world, changing context, and they don't have to study up on history. I mean, it's comforting to go into your own little box and go la 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 la, because you can convince yourself of anything. So, you know, in Shapiro's world, I'm sure he thinks that neoliberalism is great and that trade, you know, is the bee's knees. But in reality, that's not always the case. And so when somebody goes against that grain, it's they're wrong, or yeah, they're autocratic, or they're ideologically not right.
Right. Hence,
a lot of, if I just add in one quick point, I'm not a libertarian. I'm definitely not a libertarian, but I do read Reason magazine sometimes. A lot of the times their articles just make her angry, but sometimes I find them interesting. And Nick Gillespie for a long time has said that we were in a quote unquote, I think he called it like the never ending 21st century. And I disagree with his primary premise on that, but I would say he was right in a way. And what the issue essentially, as Gabe sort of just mentioned with two sides, is that the world order after World War II was not natural because it arose out of unnatural circumstances. Nobody would say, except for Hitler, that warfare is mankind's natural state. But after World War II, it was an ideological war, a cold war, between two ideologies. Prior to World War I, which is what I think the political landscape is slowly coming to resemble more and more in the way I just see liberal democracies and illiberal democracies, like there used to be liberal monarchies and illiberal monarchies, is that we're returning more to an end to what Gillespie would have called the never-ending 21st century. We're returning to a political landscape that makes more ideological sense in terms of who's in the coalition. As Gabe sort of mentioned, the two forms of conservatism in America that arose after World War II are diametrically opposed to one another. You know, having free trade and an open globalized market versus having a sense of place and a sense of who you are and an identity are two diametrically opposed ideas that only lumped themselves together to oppose Soviet communism. It was an unnatural political order, and now we're sort of getting back to what we had before the post-World War II order, World War II being itself just a creation of the inadequacies of the treaties that brought to an end the First World War. So we're returning to a pre-World War I system, pre-World War I landscape, if you will.
Right. Well, that kind of goes back to my point at the very beginning of the podcast. Like I said, you know, I don't think that people like John Bolton or people who are neocons, you know, I think if I may criticize our own AM First, you know, crowd, and I wouldn't even say this is a criticism, but just more like an observation, I think a lot of them tend to think that, you know, neocons are inherently evil. And I think that's kind of a mistake. I don't think they're evil. I think they have good intentions. I just think that they view the world in which they do because, as Josh just said, and as I said earlier, they view things kind of, you know, during the World War II era and during the Cold War era where we kind of had to stand up and be the world leaders, be the world police, you know. And if we didn't take the reins, who would have? The whole world kind of depended on us. But now we're seeing, you know, as Josh just said, kind of regression back to World War One policy. The other thing, back to, you know, what Gabe was saying about Shapiro, I think not only when you're ideologically comfortable, but kind of when you can make money off that ideology too, I think is a big motivation for the Jonah Goldberg, you know, and the Ben Shapiro's of the world. They're making money off of that type of ideology too.
There's actually a term for that. What Gabe referred to earlier is the think tanks and all that. I've begun seeing a lot of pundits. Lauren Southern wrote a lot of her book with respect to this. But she talked about Conservatism Inc., Conservatism Incorporated, those who were basically making money off of working at think tanks or whatever. The people who in Virginia, whose entire livelihood revolves around sitting around and dreaming up ideological fantasies all day instead of actually working.
But what does that make us? What does that make us though? Because I mean, like I dream about, you know, what I want to do. I'm trying to start a Patreon for my podcast. And
Sam, we're the commentariat. We actually react and comment on reality. We don't just sit around and daydream all day. But
the thing about the think tanks is a lot of their ideas never become reality. They just tend to parrot what is going on in the current day. Yeah. I mean, the think tanks didn't come up with the idea of the Soviet Union being the greatest enemy in the world. That happened naturally in terms of people seeing it that way and past presidents framing the conflict with the Soviet Union in that way. And they just kind of parroted it.
That's a good point. I mean, think tanks are, you know, it is basically all theory, and you know, we are more commentariats, you know, and granted, I mean, I think the other thing too is we admit, at least I do, try to admit when I'm wrong, and I think everyone here does, and it's more based on our observation and whatnot. So any other points you want to bring up? Or we have some chats actually that I kind of want to go to. But if anyone has anything,
well, does Gabe have more questions? I kind of like the way he's been guiding us.
Gabe, do you have any more questions?
Well, I mean, I had a list of five, and I think we've kind of touched on all five. So unless you guys have anything else, you know, you want to discuss or you want to expand on any of the points that we've made, I think we've run through my list of questions pretty well.
I would just point out, with particular respect to Trump's trade policies and how it relates to foreign policy, because I said at the very beginning of the podcast, the thing that Trump, and I don't even know if he is perhaps most concerned about it, but certainly his advisors or people who were quote-unquote his brain for a long time, like Steve Bannon were, was China's Belt and Road Initiative. And what that is foreign policy, partially domestic policy, partially infrastructure and trade. And it's a huge initiative of Chinese President Xi Jinping's, which essentially boils down to a multi-billion-dollar infrastructure project across Asia, Central Europe, Europe, and parts of the Middle East, to try and reorient global trade with China at the center. And if I can maybe have Sam link it in the description of our video or something, or maybe we'll tweet it. They actually made a creepy English language propaganda video promoting this, and it's basically. It's basically an Orwellian kind of song with a bunch of children singing about how great free trade is and opening up all the borders is and the kind of things that little five-year-olds naturally think about. But it's really strange and bizarre to watch, but they ran this propaganda video. And anyways, Xi's it's his major achievement of his life presidency, if you will, so far. And he's working on it meticulously. And I think that's why you see Trump going so gung-ho with the trade war in China and also looking more to Eastern Europe and Russia specifically, because if we're going to counter them, we need to saddle up and get on our horse now before they succeed in rearranging global trade with them at the center. I definitely believe in a multipolar world, but the Chinese definitely do not. They are more interested in China basically telling everybody else, sit down, shut up, and do what we tell you as long as you toe our line and make sure we're the first in the world, we'll let you have a little domestic variance. But otherwise, we want you to toe our line with respect to us without challenging us on anything. And we've seen that with the way they've sort of bullied. They've used their financial clout to bully companies in America. A man here in Omaha who worked for Marriott Hotels made a comment on a private Twitter account of theirs about Tibet, and the next thing he knows, he loses his job because the Chinese are like, oh, well, you know, if your employees want to badmouth the way we treat the Tibetans, then we guess we don't need your hotels in China or any other number of companies, as Sam mentioned with the movies. So I think that's why you see Trump doubling down so much on trade with China with respect to his foreign policy, because of the Belt and Road Initiative. And I would encourage all of our readers to look into that. It used to be prior to Xi being around, it was this quote unquote Asian highways conspiracy theory. I don't know if anybody ever heard of that, but they were building at the time, the Chinese were building highways all over across the regions I previously mentioned, and conspiracy theorists thought it was some sort of secret military project to invade the West, which was of course nonsense. But what it actually was laying the groundwork for this Belt and Road Initiative, which has been going on for a while now, but Xi's come out and made it his own, really. He's rebranded it as part of his personality cult.
Yeah.
I will say in terms of China that Trump, unlike past presidents, he's not afraid to take on China, regardless of the consequences, good or bad. And whereas we've heard past presidents use, rhetorically at least criticize China, whether it's Mitt Romney or Obama or Bush, they never acted on it. So, Trump is willing to push back against that kind of thing, especially when China does it to us, because China's been getting away with it with us for a long time.
All I can say is this pretty much sums up Trump's presidency as a whole, whether it be domestic or foreign, but he has giant cojones of steel. and I don't think that's an understatement either. I think he's the right man to lead. I think he's the right man to lead the country, and perhaps to lead the new world order, as we're starting to see, things, shape.
I think Trump is the right president for the world order, for a changing world order.
Yeah.
As Josh would say, a more natural world order. Trump is the one who's best at out of all the candidates who ran, I think he's the best at adapting to it and acknowledging it.
There is definitely a new world shaping up. But I'm not going to say much about that tonight, because I think that's going to be perfect for our in 2 weeks from now, when we discuss the aftermath of his summit with Putin in Helsinki, the way we see the map sort of being and you all know the map I'm talking about, but our viewers don't yet, our listeners, I should say, the way we see the map moving and reshaping itself, the two blocks that I see forming and that a few other commentators have in the press as well, is interesting. And I think Trump is, as Gabe mentioned, the president for that moment for us. And I will we'll discuss that more in some other time. But yeah.
Yeah. I have one question in the chat. The rest are just kind of comments about how, the show is pretty good and whatnot, which thanks for the comments. We appreciate that. The one question we did get, and I know that who this is from. This is from Lewis, and I don't know if we want to answer this now or if we want to save it to them.
I am happy to answer it.
for our Middle East panel. But he says, in your opinion, is Trump's foreign policy very unpopular with Zionists? And, do we want to answer that now or save that for the Middle East? For the Middle East panel,
I will say briefly, I don't know how you could think, I don't know how Zionists would dislike his foreign policy, considering that he moved the United States embassy to Jerusalem. I would say that his foreign policy I will save the rest of my comments on this for the Middle East one, but I would say his policy is definitely unpopular with Christians in the Middle East. But we'll get, and that might change after the Helsinki summit, because that will tie into Syria a little bit, but that's all I'll say on that for now. But with Zionists, I would say he's generally pretty popular right now because of the Jews.
I'd agree with Josh and say I don't see how a Zionist can be unhappy with Trump if they were happy with any prior president, because Trump has done more for them, not just in terms of his rhetoric but in terms of his actions, than any prior president. So, I would think that they would be pretty happy with him if they were ever happy with anybody before him.
Right.
I would note for the record, just on the show, and I think I might be the only guy on the panel who disagrees with Trump on this. I generally like the guy, and I love his foreign policy, as you may have guessed so far. But on Jerusalem, I did vehemently disagree with the Jerusalem movement. I think I'm the only one of our hosts with that position.
I did not disagree with him. I praised him, and we'll probably, Josh and I will probably get into a boxing match over that.
We'll have that conversation,
Next panel. So I can see just Josh just polishing his guns and ammunition right now. Just polishing his handgun right now.
I have my little Syrian and Palestinian flag. Actually, you can't see it, but it is on my I don't know what I would really call it, sort of a desk thing that I have all my little decorations and stuff on behind me.
Well, you can't.
It's funny, Sam, because I recently got a statue of Saint Michael the Archangel, and he's in his battle armor with his sword and his shield, and then his wings are spread out, and then on either side of the wings, sort of supporting it, are on one side the Syrian flag and then the Palestinian flag. So it's sort of like polishing my sword and my shield, you could say.
Interesting. And you know, I'll just say this. I'm thinking about maybe joining PragerU down the road. So, you know, read into that what you will. But anyway, unless anyone else has any other things they'd like to mention, I'll go ahead and intro us out, I guess. So, gentlemen, any final thoughts?
Can't say I have anything. Not right now. I'm excited for our next foreign policy one in 2 weeks, which I think I will. I'll technically be hosting that one, except I'll leave the questions to Sam.
I think we're all looking forward to that. By the way, the title of this episode, just so you guys know, is Foreign Policy Panel, Part 1. So we'll have Part 2 and then Part 3, and maybe we'll do like a trilogy of these. I don't know. So, but
well, it'll have a bigger box office than Star Wars.
Oh yeah. It'll probably be way better than that.
I actually do have a final thought now, totally unrelated to foreign policy.
Sure.
But since everybody mentioned Star Wars, I believe I saw that the Jar Jar Binks actor was suicidal or something like that.
Yeah, I heard that. So
I would encourage our listeners to maybe extend him a prayer or something, because even if Jar Jar was awful, I don't think he was that awful.
I don't think the person was awful.
Yeah, he was suicidal after the... but it's more of an older story than a current one. He just kind of came out about how he was depressed and suicidal with all the bullying that was happening. Same with the Kelly Marie Tran who played Rose. She actually had to erase her Instagram account because of all the death threats and all the bullying.
Yeah,
well, I'm glad it had a kind of happy ending then, if he's not suicidal anymore.
I will say this. Interesting enough, you bring up Star Wars, and this actually does tie back to foreign policy a bit. So I will just say this: like I said, the reason why you see so many blockbusters like Star Wars and whatnot deteriorating, and we may have to have like a big Hollywood panel at some point, but the reason why so many of these quote unquote big blockbuster films aren't what they used to be is because Hollywood has basically sold out to the big Chinese investors now, and all they care about, it's a purely an economic game.
It's the overseas market for movies is where a lot of movies actually make or break it.
Oh yeah. So see, we did tie everything back together in a nice neat bow. So, but I think delving into big Hollywood would be an interesting discussion. But you know, I guess for now, that wraps up this week's discussion. And I believe we've done, I hosted the first week, Joshua hosted last week, and Gabe hosted this week. So Adam, you're up next to host episode 4, I guess. So, you know, look forward to that, ladies and gentlemen. And thanks to the 5 people who tuned in live and commented. We really appreciate that. Please go to our website, AmericanWatchman.org, and read all of our columns there. And from all of us here at American Watchman, have a good night and God bless. And we'll see you next week. Thank you. And God bless.